good evening once again. You are tuned to listener-sponsored commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM on the internet at WBAI.org. Coming up at 6 p.m. will be a report of the day's news with the WBAI news team. Right now it's 5 p.m. Please stay tuned for Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, November 11th, 2002. Ready to roll. That is the headline of the San Francisco Chronicle, Thursday, November 7th. The GOP wins, seen as a go-ahead to attack Iraq. The resounding Republican victory in Tuesday's election gave the Republican Party and President George W. Bush a green light to pursue aggressive actions against Iraq. And on the local United States front, new judges, oil drilling, tax cuts planned. The Republican leaders offered an ambitious domestic agenda Wednesday that includes tax cuts, drilling for oil in the Alaska wilderness, and a new push for conservative judges, so reports the San Francisco Chronicle. The first order of business will be to reintroduce the Homeland Security, the Department of Homeland Security, and the sticking point, which was the exemption of 170,000 federal workers from civil service rules, an exemption that the AFL-CIO has been fighting against, and rightly so. Bush's faith-based initiative, that is, for social services to be handled by religious organizations, and an energy plan that emphasizes production rather than conservation. In other words, opening up our wilderness areas to more profiteering that is already taking place in these wilderness areas for the corporations, the cronies of either the Democrats or the Republicans. And then also there's a plan for terrorism insurance for businesses and a prescription drug plan that has actually been written by the health maintenance organizations and the pharmaceutical companies. In other words, it's just shuffling federal money to the major corporations. So ready to roll. These are the new plans, according to the San Francisco Chronicle. And today's Taking Aim is going to be in two parts. First, we're going to deal with ready to roll in the United States, and then ready to roll against Iraq. Ralph?
Ready to roll, Maya, encompasses something more than a domestic agenda. The Moscow Times reported yesterday that the article that we cited last week in our show from William Arkin in the Los Angeles Times pertaining to the panoply of covert operations that have been put in place has a very particular clause, and that is there will be provocations by these covert operations to entice terrorists into attack in order to allow for a U.S. response. And that goes to the issue of Ridge's declarations that there will be indisputably and without any question biological and even nuclear attacks on the United States, and he means contamination of nuclear power stations and the introduction of biological agents.
Well, let's take a closer look at this past election last Tuesday. In the Senate, the Democratic Party lost three seats and thus gave the Republican Party a slim majority. The Democratic Party before holding it with an even slimmer majority. And in the House, the Democrats lost five seats. Now, the loss in the Senate brought into the Senate Elizabeth Dole, who was elected senator from North Carolina. John Cornyn, a Republican, was elected from Texas, Bush's home state. And then Norm Coleman won in Minnesota. In the position that had been left vacant, Walter Mondale had taken over in the last few days.
After Wellstone was taken out.
Right. After the death of Paul Wellstone when his plane mysteriously went down, killing Wellstone and a good deal of his family.
Maya, actually, when you look at this carefully, Robert Reich, who was a Wall Street pundit and operative of the Democratic Party and a Clinton figure, wrote in the Washington Post that the Democratic Party is totally adrift, and he says, why didn't the Democrats break through on the economy since it's such an easy target and it's number one in the voters' minds? It's because they completely submitted to the Republican agenda. They support the Republican agenda with respect to the suppression at home, the permanent war abroad. And he goes on to say, the economy is a big problem. It isn't your typical business cycle. It hasn't responded to the Fed's usual medicine. The recovery will remain anemic for years. The Democratic problem is they don't have an economic message. They support Bush's big tax cut and even his plan to make it permanent. How can we have a consistent economic message when we're all over the map on the tax cut? The article in the Post on the 10th of November is very clear. There is only one big property party with two names, and that goes to the perceptions of the American public themselves. Maya, I spoke yesterday to Curtis Gans, who is the director of the Committee for the Study of the American Electorate in Washington, D.C. It was instructive, because Curtis Gans told me that he estimates that at best 38% of the eligible voters participated in the election, and that's down from 1998. And when you actually allow for the fact, as Gans pointed out to me, that there is a persistent and deliberate undercount of the eligible voting population in the United States, to the extent that the Census Bureau is now under court order to provide data on their deliberate undercount, and the Census Bureau has refused to comply, that 37% is a very misguided number. It's substantially less than that because of the undercount, and not to mention the fact that a large number of our population is disallowed to vote because of their having been in prison. 2 million people are in prison now. It's targeting the poor, the working class, and the black population. So in reality, what we're talking about here is a vanishingly small participation in the national and in the congressional elections by the population, because they see there's nothing out there for them. People are not buying into the non-choice, the evil lesser.
And the USA Today, on November 5th, had an article about the voting by people in the age group of 18 to 24, the first-time voters. In non-presidential elections, the percentage of this age group that are voting is about 25%. That is 1 in 4. These people, the youth of our society, can see that neither party of the major parties is making any sense. And in many cases, they vote for third-party candidates, particularly the Green Party. Such that in California, where the choice was between Gray Davis or
Bill Simon,
Bill Simon, a corporate owner, or a man who is a political hack who has the pretense of being pro-labor but always falls short, for instance, with the farm workers when they put forward legislation that would allow for them to actually get contracts when they do win union elections, and instead what the bosses do is protract, delay, so that it leads to a point where it goes on years and the unions still don't have a contract even though they've won the elections. In California, Peter Camejo, who is the Green Party candidate for governor, and some of you may remember from his years in the SWP when he used to run for president, he won more than 5% of the vote in California. That came to 800,000 votes. And most of them came from these first-time voters.
Maya, when you really look at this, you see that the Democrats and Republicans are essentially splitting a middle-class vote with about a 1% lead for the Republicans. The so-called Republican sweep of the election reflects nothing more than about 16% of the voting-age Americans. That is a landslide. I'd like to know what a defeat is. 16%, and that's generous, are engaged in support for the Republican Party. And the truth of the matter is that the great mass of the population has elected to opt out of this facade, this farce. Even the veneer of differences that have been presented as between the one big property party with two names is losing any credible source of belief in the population. The war on working people at home and abroad is pursued by both parties. The tax cut for big business is supported by both parties. The repression and the permanent war. And when you look carefully at what they're both planning, both parties are on board to break the unions in this country, as they have consistently and together. Notwithstanding the fact that the trade union bureaucracy has illusions about the Democratic Party, like they do with Gray Davis in California, who not only backs the death penalty, but every anti-labor piece of legislation that he can contrive.
Well, let's look at what the unions did in this election, because unions represent 13 million workers in the United States. Now, the AFL-CIO did a survey. They used Peter DeHart research, and they did a survey of union members as they left the polls. And what they found is that in the U.S. House, 68% voted for Democrats, and in the Senate, 70% voted for Democrats. So that when you look at the difference between Democrat versus Republican, for all union members, over a third of them made the difference in terms of the Democratic vote. There was a 36% difference between Democrat and Republicans. And if you go to urban areas where there's a greater concentration of union members, the difference was 48%, almost half. In other words, the vote by the union members for the Democratic Party made a difference in those elections. And what were those elections? There were 25 gubernatorial races, 16 Senate races, 47 congressional races, and dozens of competitive state legislative races that the AFL-CIO targeted. And let's look at the labor power of the AFL-CIO in terms of getting out the vote and getting out their message. According to the AFL-CIO, this was one of the most expensive elections. $710 million was spent by the big corporations to win their votes, while the AFL-CIO spent $62 million. That's a lot of money to feed into the Democrats, even though the AFL-CIO says that what they did with the money was focus on messages. Their messages were really in support of these Democratic candidates. Now, local activists, that is union members, distributed nearly 17 million leaflets. In other words, the AFL-CIO saw that it didn't have the money to compete on the TV and on the radio. So what they did is person to person, one on one, getting out the vote and also distributing 17 million leaflets, 5 million phone calls, and mailing through the mail 15 million pieces of mail to other union members. Not only that, on election day, 225,000 grassroots volunteers, that means union members, knocked on doors, made phone calls, handed out flyers at workplaces, and urged workers to vote. And as well, the AFL-CIO gave leave, because you're not allowed to do electioneering on the job, to 750 staff members of the AFL-CIO and affiliated unions. These were the so-called volunteers. Now, this is enormous labor power that went towards the Democratic Party when, in fact, there could have been using this power, using this money for having a real voice for working people, a labor party. Ralph.
Well, yes, please.
I was thinking that it would be really good to look at the situation in Minnesota, where you had Mondale, who was the so-called liberal, coming, who had been vice president, who had been a presidential candidate, who had been the ambassador to Japan, and was seen as by the Democratic Party as its last hope in the few days that there were before the election, and having to overcome the fact that the absentee ballots that had gone to Paul Wellstone wouldn't be counted for the Democratic Party. And by the way, that was the margin that allowed the Republicans to win. I think it would be good to really go and look at who Mondale really is, and because who he is really has a lot of significance for what the Democratic Party is really about.
Okay, let's do that. But let me just amplify what you were saying and what I had mentioned previously about the actual participation of American voters, because there was a very interesting study in Newsmax and picked up by United Press International on this very theme that Curtis Gans had been illuminating. There's been below average turnout in the states with the highest participation, New York and California. The three midterm elections during the 1990s had a turnout of below 33%. This current election has an even lower percentage overall. Thomas Patterson, United Press International, who was a professor at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and wrote a book called The Vanishing Voter, documented how, proportionately, the turnout in the 2002 midterm is substantially below that of 40 years ago. And the article concludes, Americans are turned off by both parties and their campaign politics. Regardless of what they actually feel about the direction of the nation, they are disenchanted with these parties and the elections. Very large majorities of the American people believe that money, I'm quoting, has more influence on the outcome of elections than voters do, that candidates talk to them but don't tell them the truth, that the campaigns are theater with little effort to address the nation's real problems. Increasingly, then, even the established press is acknowledging what we, of course, have been emphasizing for a very long time, that the population of this country is disaffected, that as much as 85% of our people have no use for either of the two parties of capital, and that working-class Americans in particular are not responding to labor bureaucrats and are choosing to opt out, not because of acquiescence in the right-wing agenda, but because they perceive that that agenda is the politics, are the politics of each party. And to come to the point that you raised, Maya, about the role of the liberal Mondale. Walter Mondale, the protege of Hubert Humphrey, purported to come out of the Democratic Farm Labor Party in Minnesota, an emblem of the so-called liberal tradition of the Democratic Party. And when he ran for president in 1984, a very important article was published by Professor Thomas Ferguson and Professor Joel Rogers. It was in The Nation, and it says, "Why has Mondale turned right?" And then they go into document that, in fact, Mondale and the Liberal Democrats were supporting increased taxes of the working class and ever higher military expenditure. And when they examined it, they found that the support for Mondale was being curried from none other than the American Enterprise Institute. Now, our listeners will recall that we have documented frequently here in many of our shows that the American Enterprise Institute is the shill, the cover for Wolfowitz and Pearl, for Gene Kirkpatrick, for the so-called chicken hawks, the far right that has been the since the early 1970s, the originators of the category of terror with which to stigmatize any opposition to U.S. imperial design, and the formulators of the plan for preemptive strike and permanent war. Here is Mondale at the time of his presidential campaign, according to the New York Times, obtaining the backing and support of the American Enterprise Institute, and the article says virtually all the Democratic business leaders favor increase in the military budget, including Walter Mondale. And the report in The Nation at the time says, the leading investment bankers are overrepresented among the major contributors to the Mondale campaign and to Democrats for the 80s. Mondale and the Democrats received substantial funds from the partners and executives at Lehman Brothers, Kern Loeb, Goldman Sachs, Brown Brothers Harriman, Lazar Frere, and Prudential Bache. In fact, the article states, Prudential Bache sunk so much money into Mondale and the Democratic organization that the Democrats' real emblem was the Rock of Gibraltar. Quote, a virtual first mortgage on the Mondale candidacy has been taken out by investment bankers, insurance company executives, and the business elites, for whom a cut in the deficit and increase the military spending constitutes the political program that they provide and that they prefer. These conservative groups are the elite core of the Mondale campaign. Now let's look, Maya, at the so-called 1984, we're talking conservative groups, and there you will see the entire grouping that now is bunched around Bush: the Pearls, the Armitages, the Richard Pipes, the Gene Kirkpatricks, the Wolfowitz, the Elliot Abrams. In fact, the very people who were associated with Ronald Reagan were key elite core figures in the Mondale campaign. The powerful businesses, notably weapons producers, and I'm still quoting them from the article in The Nation of the time, for whom the deficit appears as an entry in the sales column, and labor-intensive manufacturers are the behind-the-scenes controllers of the Mondale campaign. Henry Kaufman, the chief financial analyst of Salomon Brothers, was a principal figure. And the chief counselors on foreign policy to Walter Mondale turned out to be James Schlesinger and Max Kampelman, who accompanied Mondale for his briefings at the National Security Council. Now let's look at these people. James Schlesinger was the consultant to the investment house of Shearson, Lehman, American Express. His views were identical to those of Ronald Reagan, whose campaign Schlesinger directed in 1976. Here we have Schlesinger directing the campaign of Reagan in 76 as the key national security figure for Mondale in 1984. The James Schlesinger story is illuminating for what it tells us about these so-called two parties. He was director of the Strategic Studies Program at the RAND Corporation. He was a senior staff member advising John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson from 1963 through 1969. He directed the budget in the Bureau of the Budget for Richard Nixon in 1969, and Schlesinger was Nixon's co-director at the Office of Management and Budget in 1971. Schlesinger was Nixon's chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission for 3 years. He then became Gerald Ford's director of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1973 and his Secretary of Defense from 1973 to 75. So from Kennedy to Johnson to Reagan to Mondale to Ford to Nixon, same duck, same bird, same character. He helped run Ronald Reagan's challenge to General Ford's nomination in 1976. When Gerald Ford lost to Jimmy Carter, why, James Schlesinger became the personal assistant to President Carter. And Carter appointed him Secretary of the Department of Energy, where he served for 3 years. When Schlesinger was Secretary of Defense under Richard Nixon, he was, quote, more hawkish, unquote, than his boss. Instructive to note, James Schlesinger advocated first strike capability and became the senior staff person at the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown University, where he devised a preemptive strike strategy for U.S. imperialism. He divided his services between devising stratagems for strategic nuclear attacks for the Pentagon and his services as a financial director for Shearson, Lehman, and American Express. Now, his associate and a key figure for Walter Mondale at the time that he was the presidential candidate, the Liberal Democratic candidate in 1984, is even more revealing. Because Campbellman's relationship to Walter Mondale long antedates that of James Schlesinger. Max Campbellman counseled a young Mondale when Mondale was the protege of Hubert Humphrey, and while Campbellman was serving on the council for Hubert Humphrey from 1949 to 1955. Max Campbellman was Lyndon Johnson's advisor to the U.S. mission to the United Nations from 1966 to 1967 during the height of the air bombardment of Indochina, of which he was an architect. He served in the right-wing Atlantic Council of the United States from 1965 to 1970, and he is a founder of the neoconservative Committee on the Present Danger. It is the Committee on the Present Danger, around which Pearl and Armitage and Rumsfeld and Ashcroft and Wolfowitz have organized their campaign on terror, so-called, since the 1970s, have targeted the oil in the Arab Gulf, which they called a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistador, contrived the war in Iraq, the war in Central Asia, 9/11 itself. Look at the role of Campbellman as a founder of the Neoconservative Committee on the Present Danger. That grew into a coalition for a Democratic majority, of which Campbellman was vice chairman, and this group advocated the far-right policies that are now associated with the Chicken Hawks, except that they advocated them for the Democratic Party. He reestablished, did Campbellman, the Committee on the Present Danger to address the communist menace worldwide, and his co-members comprised a who's who of the neoconservatives who campaigned for Ronald Reagan and were among Reagan's principal advisors. These included Midge Dekter, Norman Podhoretz, Leon Kaiserling, Jean Kirkpatrick, Richard Pipes, Richard Pearl, Kenneth Armitage. Pipes was Ronald Reagan's chief advisor on the Soviet Union. Kirkpatrick, who was slightly to the right of Genghis Khan, was the United Nations ambassador for Ronald Reagan. Now, none of this should surprise us because Campbellman and Kirkpatrick co-authored The Strategy of Deception in 1963, which was a polemic on the world communist conspiracy, which identified trade unions, social reform movements, any opposition amongst the peasants or poor of the world as a communist conspiracy that had to be met by preemptive and covert operations. When we look carefully at this panoply of people who are behind Mondale's candidacy in 1984 and who are the key figures in the so-called liberal wing of the Democratic Party, we begin to understand very clearly what it is that this party represents, why it is that it cannot and will not mount any resistance to the so-called agenda of the far right of the Republican Party. It's the same birds, brothers and sisters, the same folk, the same apparatus, the same ruling class, and the same architects of permanent war and state terror and repression in the United States.
There is a great divide between the rulers who are nominally elected to Congress or to be the President of the United States and the people of the United States. And yet the AFL-CIO is still packaging and trying to sell these Democrats to the workers who understand better. So that when the AFL-CIO polls union members as what are their to ask what are their priorities, their priorities are the crackdown on the very corporations that are funding the Democrat and Republican parties. They want to protect retirement. Over 80%, 4 out of 5 union members said these are their priorities. They want to create and protect jobs. 3 out of 4 union members said that. They want affordable health coverage. Again, 3 out of 4 union members. And they want to, again, protect Social Security. While both the Democrats and the Republicans have gone support the privatization of Social Security, funneling the money back into Wall Street. Now, what we have today, as a result of the one big property party, is that in the U.S., there are fewer manufacturing jobs than there were in 1963, almost 40 years ago. Just between 2000 and 2002, 33 steel companies filed for bankruptcy, and so 43 steelworker jobs, union jobs, were lost, and 116 textile plants closed. According to the Economic Policy Institute, as a result of NAFTA and the WTO, and remember, the Democrats voted for Fast Track this very year. According to the Economic Policy Institute, NAFTA and the WTO have cost U.S. workers more than 3 million actual and potential jobs since 1994. You have been listening to Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, listener-sponsored radio, and on the Internet at www.wbai.org. You can reach us by email at takingaim@patbell.net. That's PACBELL.net. PacBell stands for Pacific Bell. That's takingaim@pacbell.net. We now have a voicemail at WBAI, so you can make a local call to leave a message for us, and that would be 212-209-2953. That's 212-209-2953. If you'd like to write to us, you can do so at Taking Aim, P.O. Box 6345. That's P.O. Box 6345, Vallejo, V as in victory, A-L-L-E-J-O, California, 94591. Now, our program today had two parts. First was the election. And now let's go and look at the ready to roll, the U.S. invasion of Iraq. Ralph?
You know, there's been a huge emphasis on the part of many in the anti-war movement on the role of the United Nations and of so-called international law. And we've attempted on Taking Aim to point out that the United Nations is nothing if it isn't a compilation of regimes and governments that have the same class structure as we have in the United States. What has happened to the Iraqi people? There's a killing of 1.5 million people and 750,000 people, children, through sanctions is the act of the United Nations. The war on Iraq, the Gulf War, was carried out under the cover of the United Nations. The suffering of the people of Iraq through the aegis and legitimization of the United Nations, as in the Congo, as in Korea, as in Palestine, as in the Balkans, as in Yugoslavia. The San Francisco Chronicle, on November 9th, reported on the unanimous vote for the United Nations resolution on Iraq and described it as follows: a kid glove over a metal fist. And it stated that this resolution contained provocative items. Let's look at those provocative items. The provisions allow inspections to be carried out, as the Chronicle itself states, in such an aggressive and intrusive manner that Saddam Hussein will have no ability to implement them and will trigger the U.S. invasion. 1. Iraq has 30 days to provide a complete list of all weapons, research programs, and facilities, including an itemization of all materials not related to weapon production, that is to say, everything produced in civilian factories and all medical research facilities. Now, bear in mind that Scott Ritter, the former chief inspector, has declared that there are no such weapons. And secondly, that his operation was an intelligence operation from the get-go, that he was reporting to the Mossad and to the Central Intelligence Agency, and that 85% of the areas that they would inspect would then be targeted for carpet bombing. Hans Blix, who is the chief inspector who will head the current United Nations inspection team, stated that the Security Council requests for Iraq are such that Iraq is wholly unable to provide this information in the time allowed. Blix stated it is simply impossible, physically impossible, to do an inventory of what is produced all over the country in civilian factories and in medical research facilities, and to itemize this and provide it within 30 days.
Ralph, a senior U.S. administration official, briefed reporters on condition of
anonymity,
remaining anonymous, so he wouldn't lose his job, but he wanted the information out. They stated that if any single disclosure fails to match information supplied already by American and other Western intelligence agency, by which they mean the Israelis particularly, because the Israelis have already admitted that they've sent special forces into Iraq, as has the U.S., send special forces right into Baghdad. Now, they have said is that if what the Iraqis supply doesn't match the information that they've already gathered or that they say they have gathered, that an attack will follow swiftly.
That anonymous official wasn't worried so much about losing his job. It's that he was high rank and he wanted this word out. And it's a commonplace to have a deep throat that leaks to the press what they intend to obtain acquiescence for in the population.
Yes, you're right.
And what the senior U.S. administration official was stating was that they're making it up as they go along at the Central Intelligence Agency, and if their list of what Iraq has don't correspond to what is there or what the Iraqis acknowledge, the attack will follow. So it's a no-win. I mean, as Rumsfeld once put it, the absence of evidence does not mean that there's evidence of absence. How's that for 1984 speak?
Now, the UN inspectors can inspect any site in the country that's in Iraq. That includes the private residences of leaders, the presidential palaces, the government centers, and then they can declare these as, quote, exclusion zones from which no Iraqi can leave or enter, and in which all ground, auto, aerial movement is forbidden. Now, these inspectors can also confiscate anything from these sites that they consider
appropriate to take.
And furthermore, the inspectors can call out any Iraqi official out of the country and make them come with their families. And this includes weapons scientists or government personnel, anyone that they want to interrogate.
So in essence, what we're talking about here is not just a spy operation, but a military operation targeting the private residence of Saddam Hussein and other Iraqi leaders, their offices, the presidential palaces, which will be called exclusion zones. They can actually prevent the leaders of that government from entering their own offices and homes and seize whatever is there. And any attempt to resist this will be declared a breach.
As what President Bush said in his remarks on the UN Security Council resolution, which is 1441, quote, he must submit to any and all methods to verify his compliance. His cooperation must be prompt and unconditional, or he will face the severest consequences.
And he goes on to say, Maya, that the Iraqis are forbidden by this UN resolution from interfering with any member state taking action in Iraq to uphold the inspections, and that includes military activity in the so-called no-fly zones. That means that the U.S. and British attack planes that have been bombarding southern Iraq for the past month can continue to bomb Iraqi military bases and sites and infrastructure, and on the basis of this so-called resolution of the United Nations, any resistance, quote, will violate the resolution and give a green light for war, the Chronicle outlines. So the constant aerial attacks cannot be opposed or resisted. In fact, in reality, not even members of the Security Council had ever approved those overflights or no-fly zones, which are a de facto partitioning of Iraq. Dennis Halliday was the former head of the UN Food for Oil program, and Halliday stated, "I cannot imagine this system working. Iraq can't win. This is a dangerous resolution, which is a simple excuse for military action to give the United States the respectability and cover of the United Nations for Bush's war."
Ready to roll. That is what Halliday is saying, essentially, and that is what The Guardian reported. It said the U.S. is, quote, ready for war by next month, that the U.S. hawks are prepared to leak their, quote, intelligence on weapons to inspectors and to engineer the crisis and precipitate an attack. Now, we have to remember also that 250,000 troops are to be called out, that the plans that we had talked about of General Tommy Franks, the massive plan of 250,000 to 300,000 troops, has been accepted. It's no longer, are they talking about 85,000 troops. They're going for the full court press, the 250,000 to 300,000 troops. And furthermore, they are, what had first been intimated is now being talked about all over the press. The U.S. has revealed that they are anticipating a long-term occupation of Iraq. We are back up to the $200 billion cost of this war. Now, Reuters has once again reiterated what Ralph and I have been reporting time and again, that this occupation, this invasion, is going to be preceded by carpet bombing of 1,200 sorties a day for at least a month. And the depleted uranium that will be unleashed on Iraq is expected to be three times that of the Gulf War.
And to understand what that means, as we've reported, the thalidomide-like deformities that have spread across Iraq at the hospitals, at the clinics, at the maternity clinics, it is a devastating destruction of not only this current generation of Iraqis, but many, many generations to come. And the Toronto Sun revealed yesterday that they're not only preparing for this war and have already made this a foregone conclusion as far as U.S. military rulers and Bush's people are concerned, but the Toronto Sun documented that U.S. rulers have already made preparations for the war to follow against Iran. Israel has already given the green light, quote, thanks to long-range F-151 supplied by the U.S., plus cruise and ballistic missiles. Israel and the U.S. are primed to strike targets all over Iran. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon declared, Iran will be invaded the day after Iraq is crushed, unquote.
Now, Israel comes into play also. And the USA Today reporter John Diamond reported on November 5th, Israel reportedly helping with U.S. war preparation. Just what you've been saying. Not just potential for Iran, but here they've been playing, according to John Diamond, a key role in the U.S. preparations for the war with Iraq. What are they doing? The Israelis are training soldiers and Marines for urban warfare, conducting clandestine surveillance missions in the western Iraqi desert, as I reported before, those special forces, and allowing the U.S. to place combat supplies in Israel. Now, all this information came to USA Today directly from the U.S. defense and intelligence officials. Now, let's look at it a little closely. Israeli commandos, using their own satellite intelligence and imagery provided by U.S. intelligence services, have conducted clandestine surveillance missions of Scud missile sites in western Iraq. And then also, the Israelis have built in Israel itself two mock cities, complete with mosques, hanging laundry, and an odd donkey meandering down dusty streets. And Israeli infantry units have been training the U.S. Army and Marine counterparts this summer and fall for the house-to-house, block-to-block Battle of Baghdad.
Maya, last week, in Taking Aim, we cited William M. Arkin in the Los Angeles Times in his important documented article about the vast expansion of assassination squads and black and covert operations in every corner of the world that have been unleashed by the Bush regime. The Moscow Times today followed up on the William Arkin story and disclosed that one of the primary objectives of these black covert operations is to, quote, stimulate and to actually undertake terrorist attacks in order to provoke a larger terrorist response to justify preemptive war that is already on the books. That is to say, the very scenario, not only of Operation Northwoods in 1962, but of September 11th itself. And in yesterday's Los Angeles Times, William Arkin elaborates on his previous article. Quote, in all the to and fro of debate or whether the United States should wage war against Iraq, no one is paying attention to Major General Kenneth Privratsky. Outside the tight little world of the Military Traffic Management Command, no one, Arkin writes in the Los Angeles Times, has even heard of him. Yet Privratsky's assignment tells more about the true intent and direction of the Bush administration than all the diplomatic pronouncements, the political maneuvers, and the public United Nations debates put together, he writes. Privatsky is busy shipping tens of thousands of tons of military equipment and supplies to a mushrooming net of U.S. military bases that have sprung up like dragon's teeth, I'm quoting, across Central Asia and the Middle East. Amongst the resources he is using is the Russian railway system. I never imagined I would be involved in shipping vast cargoes through Russia, the former traffic command chief said. An army marches on its stomach, Napoleon famously observed. There's no more voracious military stomach than today's U.S. armed forces. The war on terrorism is expanding vastly beyond Afghanistan in a globe-girdling capacity, a massive buildup of military capabilities virtually without precedent. And Arkin continues, some analysts have suggested that UN weapons inspections will reduce the likelihood of war. That is hardly how senior White House and Pentagon officials sees it. None believes that this resolution or the inspections will provide much delay at all to the war that is already well underway. And he goes on in this detailed article to document that the U.S. forces are operating in Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, using a complex system of rail lines, including those of the former Soviet Union and its old satellites. They have virtually taken over the transportation system of the former Soviet Union. Privatsky and his colleagues are operational with 92% of the military cargo, distributing it for a continuing war. Prior to September 11th, Central Command's blueprint for war with Iraq. Now, this is instructive because William Arkin is telling us that prior to September 11th, all these preparations were on not just the drawing board, but an operational status. OPLAN 1003-98 calculated 10 airfields and 6 seaports to sustain air, ground, and naval forces for the attacks. The plan evolved, Arkin writes. Force levels grew, and the requirement for airfields and seaports rose to 18 and 13, respectively. Then they were expanded for 60,000 short-ton supplies a day, the equivalent of 3,500 tractor trailers driving the distance, he writes, from Tampa, Florida, to Savannah, Georgia, every day, or 5,000 daily flights by C-130, Hercules, cargo planes. Brothers and sisters, all this in motion, while the rulers are telling us that Osama bin Laden is the rationale for the war they are already not just preparing, but undertaking. And he writes, it is the logistical equivalent of loading up, moving, and unloading everyone and everything in the city of Norfolk, Virginia, a population of 230,000, including all its automobiles, to Central Asia and the Middle East. Beyond the Middle East, the article states, The U.S. bases in Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and other parts of Central Asia are in place, adding to the capability for the war that will only begin in Iraq. And the article says, the French Mirage, the F-16s, are expected from France, Norway, Denmark, and the Netherlands, all the nominal countries who have called for U.N. A fig leaf of U.N. legitimacy for this strike have already been part of the logistical buildup for the war itself. It is an extraordinarily detailed article, as important as his previous one,
Ralph,
on the black covert operations.
Ralph, what is the date so people can see the full article on the Internet?
Yes, it's November 10th, 2002. It's yesterday's article in the Los Angeles Times, Building the War Supply Lines Fill Up, by William M. Arkin.
You mean Sundays?
Sundays,
November
Los Angeles
10th.
Times, November 10th, Sunday, you're quite right, Sunday's Los Angeles Times.
And also in the Los Angeles Times, take a look at Esther Schrader's article, War Preparations Escalate in the Gulf, where she describes the movement of troops, equipment into the region that have been happening after the UN mandate. And at the same time, in the New York Times, war plan in Iraq sees large force and quick strikes. We don't have time today to go into all the movements of the troops, and believe me, there are huge ships and Navy and Air Force jets and the bombers and the special operations forces, they're all moving into place.
With weapons of mass destruction. We're talking here about the real use of biological agents, the real use of tactical nuclear weapons, the real devastation of an entire civilian population, the real activation of a genocidal plan.
Now, the outline for the urban battle is also on the Internet. In a Pentagon document that's called Doctrine for Joint Urban Operations. And by joint, that's a Pentagon speak for air, naval, ground, and the special operations forces under a single command, which is CENTCOM. Now, the report is dated September 16th, 2002, and it's on the New York Times website and was first described in an article October 21st. So remember, it's called The Doctrine for Joint Urban Operations, and what it describes is essentially the leveling of Baghdad, creating fires, cutting off the electricity, devastating the city so that the ground troops can have better mobility. It describes the urban battles, what was learned in Stalingrad, what were the lessons of Hue in Vietnam, of Grozny in Chechnya, and what the U.S. is going to do to make sure that the U.S. troops don't have the defeats of the Germans in Stalingrad, or the U.S. in Hue, or the Russians in Grozny. So take a look at these issues. Now, why is there this war? Why is the U.N., why is the U.S. pushing for the invasion of Iraq? In our last minutes, let's look
at
this.
Well, Maya, we again would turn to the Los Angeles Times and to the Financial Times in London and to the London Observer. All producing extraordinary articles which do expose the real character of the United Nations, just as we have tried to expose the nature of the Democratic Party in relation to the ruling class. The article in the Los Angeles Times, Iraqi Oil Lies Below the Surface of UN Resolutions, and the article documents that Britain, France, China, and Russia are home to the world's leading energy companies, all of whom are anxious to get access to Iraq's oil, the world's second largest reserves behind Saudi Arabia. Quote, everybody knows why the United States is doing this, said Nikolai P. Tokarov, general director of Zarubzhneft, the Russian state-owned company involved in oil production and sales in Iraq since 1967. The only reason is the U.S. desire to seize and establish full control over the entire oil complex of Iraq. All those negotiations in the United Nations about the wording of a resolution, don't believe it, brothers and sisters. Here it is in the Los Angeles Times. A key concern for Russia, France, and China is whether a new government will honor Iraq's existing agreements. Russia's Lukoil has the largest stake in Iraq, having signed a 23-year, $3.5 billion contract to develop the West Kurna oil field. France's Total Final F negotiating to explore the Majnoon fields. China's National Petroleum Corporation to contract the Rumaila field. All of them are out in the cold. They've been promised a little drop. But ExxonMobil and Chevron Texaco, the articles document, have already been promised and allocated the oil and gas of Iraq. That's what this skirmishing in the United Nations is about, brothers and sisters. It's about the oil. It's about imperial control. It's about imperial rivalry and dividing up the spoils.
Now, this was confirmed by Representative Charles Rangel, the Democrat from Manhattan, because he was in a meeting with President Bush and the House and Senate Energy Bill conferees last month when President Bush said, quote, American technology will have those oil fields even more productive, end quote, after the U.S. ends Saddam's regime. You have been listening to Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. You can reach us at takingaim@pacbell, P-A-C-B-E-L-L .net or 212-209-2953. We want to thank our associate Brad Wiedmeyer and our engineers for this show, Matthew Finch at WBAI and Erica Bridgman here at KPFA. We'll be with you next week.
And we will detail more of the war for oil, UN and U.S. together.
And that contact number again, that contact information for Taking Aim once again, phone number is 707-552-9995. For email information, that's Taking Aim, one word, at pacbell.net. Taking Aim returns, well, not next Tuesday, because we have some special programming next Tuesday, a full day of Pacifica-wide programming, raising funds for the Pacifica Radio Archives, and we'll play you just a bit of information about that, just so you'll know. But 2 weeks from now, you can tune in to Taking Aim with Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, commercial-free community radio WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM. Coming up at 6 p.m. will be a report of the day's news with the WBAI news team.
Hello, I'm Julia Butterfly Hill. Join the Pacifica Radio Network Tuesday, November 19th for A Day for the Pacifica Radio Archives, Preserving a Living History. A special broadcast to raise funds for the preservation of Pacifica's historic audio collection. At 7 a.m. Eastern Time, all five Pacifica stations will begin a 13-hour broadcast dedicated to the voices that have echoed the cry for human dignity and social justice. Voices like Rachel Carson, Jacques Cousteau, Judy Barry, Winona LaDuc, Dr. Helen Caldicott, and thousands more. For updates and program schedule, visit the Archives website at www.pacificaradioarchives.org. That's Tuesday, November 19th, A Day for the Pacifica Radio Archives, Preserving a Living History. This is Julia Butterfly Hill.